Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If. Only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
So you went through Trinity.
Yeah.
You didn't just go through Trinity. You were the president of the Students' Union.
I was.
And out of that, you were elected to Shannon.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about your experience, maybe your first few days in the Shannon? Were you confident going in there, or did confidence grow as you went along?
Yeah, I think I've always been quite good at faking for a period of time until it feels natural, you know. So people are always quite shocked when they realise that I've probably spent a couple of months having to, like, you know, like being a bit exhausted after a few months because I've been like mentally kind of focused on going, I'm grand at this, I'm good at this, and nobody can really tell that I'm like scared or, you know. And I suppose in Trinity, the first time I felt quite scared was the getting up and talking and asking for votes. Like, I was like, how can I ask somebody to vote for me? It nearly felt like shame.
Mm.
And I'm like, why do I feel shame asking someone to vote for me? And it was like asking people to have like confidence in me, to believe in me, a part of me was kind of rejecting that. And I was kind of like, I'm a fucking why are you asking anyone for that for? You don't fucking even need to do that, you know what I mean? Yeah, so it's like, it's like I was asking them for something for nothing, like, you know, with me handout or something. And it was an election and everyone else bigging themselves up, and I'm like, what's wrong with me? I'm struggling with this. And I had never publicly spoke to that many people, like, because it could be anything from like 400 people in a lecture hall, you know. Yeah. And I remember being rattling inside, and after the first day, my campaign manager, who was from Crumlin and came through the Access programme with me, there was only about three of us in the campaign. By the end of it, everyone had dropped their candidates and joined their campaign. But at the start, like, I would literally, my stomach, I would have the runs for days at the thought of even, oh God, I have to go on that talk now, and I have pains up my neck. And and then the second day, third day, I think it was, into the campaign, there's like this big kind of speech out on the dining hall steps, and it's out in front square. And Rob said, right, let's go over your speech. And I says, no, I'm just going to go tell it on them. And he's like, I don't know what that means. And I'm like, I'm just going to go tell it on them. Like, I'm just going to go community worker and tell it on them. At the end of the day, this is a community, isn't it? Like, aspirations are aspirations, and whether you're upper class or working class, there is certain things that people want. And I just need to go up and talk about that. And I went up and I just dropped the idea of having to try and talk about these policies or what I was going to do for Trinity or da 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 da. And I just spoke about community, and I spoke about equality and diversity and inclusion and what that means. And that just spoke to so many people, because whether you were disabled, or, you know, whether you had a disability, whether you were, you know, on the autism spectrum, or whether you were a migrant student, or whether you were, you know, there because you travelled from some other European country to be there, there was something about in the speech that I gave that kind of pulled everybody in, which was really quite empowering. So that was the kind of most frightened I felt, was the first day or two before I kind of just relaxed and was me. I think I was rejecting who I was the first 2 days, trying to sound like the other candidates or something, and that made me feel really ill. And then when I went into the Senate, it was hard. It was actually harder than going into Trinity for some reason, because it's so much more concentrated and there's cameras on you all the time. I didn't know if I could stop cursing for long enough to actually do a speech. Yeah. I didn't know how I was going to dress.
Yeah, I've seen you on the channel before wearing your Air Max and showing your tattoos, which is fantastic. Yeah. You know,
I definitely had to push that. You know,
yeah, is it a hard thing to do that? Like,
yeah, it was, because people are commenting on the first day or two. They're so used to a particular, like, a suit is not my uniform. Do you know what I mean? And I kind of think, like, people wearing suits, that's okay, they're comfortable in that, but like the idea that people should wear suits and work, or women should wear particular types of kind of work looking dresses or trouser suits, where did that come from? Like, you know, it's not what I wear on a day-to-day basis. It's not what I wear and what I'm comfortable in. And, you know, I really had to push back against that. And I arrived in my first day to speak in the Shannon. Now, we'd been in for a while the program of government was being, but I arrived in like this, it was really sunny. And I arrived in this little like summer dress with all my tattoos out, but it was quite short as well, so it meant all my leg tattoos were shown as well. So I was just like, just fucking go in and embrace it. And there was a couple of comments, and you can see like that people are just not used to it in there, you know. Yeah. And I think, but it kind of got, they got used to it. You know, and I remember telling the story before, but I had like this recurring dream for about 2 or 3 nights that I bought this like Tommy Hilfiger suit in Grafton Street. And I was like navy, and it's not something I would wear. Like, and in the dream, I kept putting it on and going in to speak for my maiden speech in the Shannon. And I kept turning into Mickey Mouse fleecy pajamas.
Yeah.
Every time I stood up to speak, and I'd run back to the office to try and put the suit back on. But every time I spoke, and this kept happening, and I was like, and that was kind of like the sign to me, Jesus, Lynn, is there something subconscious going on here? Yeah. Are you afraid to speak? You know, are you afraid that you're going to stand out, or your accent? Sometimes I get words completely wrong, you know, and I've had to embrace that. You know, at first I used to get embarrassed, like when someone would try and correct me word, where now I just say, yeah, did you know what I meant? So, like, fuck off. Like, exactly. Why are you correcting me for? Like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So now I had to work hard to embrace that my dialect, and go, do you know what? There's some words that I say that you know the meaning of, I know the meaning of, I say them differently, you know, and I'm not going to reject that part of me, you know?
Yeah.
And, but what's funny is, like, you know, Seb, my assistant, would write speeches for me sometimes, like if I'm too busy, or if it's not a subject that I feel that I can do justice to, just speak and ad lib on, he would write. But sometimes he puts in words and I'm like, I get to it in the middle of the speech and I go, oh my god.
My buddy jumped in, he goes, Gerald's doing this all his life. I knew exactly what he meant, because I've always tried to help people along the way before I even got into the therapy. And going back about 15 years ago then, I just, something inside me said that I need to do something more, because I had this unbelievable desire to really, really make a difference in people's lives.
Mm.
And I started studying like I never studied before, to be honest with you.
Mm.
And I absolutely loved it, and I'm still studying today. I'm learning so much more besides what I'm actually doing as a therapist now, to be the best that I can be, to make such a profound difference in people's lives.
Do you think the karate, I'd say the karate helped, because, you know, I think, you know, like for Shaolin monks, they have that martial art, it's kung fu or whatever it is, but they also have the spiritual side of it, the side where they keep themselves grounded and humble and centered.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have that in karate as well?
Yeah, you're dead right.
Yeah.
You're dead right. In fact, I've known of another few martial artists that went into the healing fraternity, you could say, you know, so there's something about it. And, you know, I was asked a question once, Joe, you were talking about spirituality. What's the difference between religion and spirituality? Well, I said, or the religious man and the spiritual man. Well, I said, the religious man fears dying and going to hell. The spiritual man has already been there.
Mm. Mm. It's true, so true, really.
True life's experiences is what you learn.
Yeah, and you going back to what you said there, we'll go, myself and James have done a few sessions with you there lately as well, and we've both had our own experiences. I haven't been really speaking to James about my own, but my experience, which I like, as you know, has been profound, really. It's after helping me an awful lot to go deep into my own past, my childhood, and other shit that's going on in my life, you know. And it's massive, you know. But I have a piece here, right? And it's the story of you helping somebody in a different situation, right? and I'm going to read it, if that's okay.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine.
On Wednesday, the 11th of July, I spoke to a very distressed member of staff who, during the conversation, said they wanted to slit their wrists. I convinced him to come into the meeting room for an informal chat. Myself and Joe Murphy sat down with him, listened and offered assistance in the form of STS's in-house supports. That's the company supports.
That's the company, yeah.
He was in a very, very dark place and he was disturbed.
Mm.
Joe thought Joe O'Brien, which is yourself, who has experience in this field, with the person's consent, Joe rang Joe, who promptly came to the meeting room. We explained the situation and then both myself and Joe left the meeting room to allow Joe proceed with his therapy techniques. After some time, Joe called us back into the meeting room and we sat down again for a chat. We found the person in question totally transformed for the person we had before us in the morning. We did not witness the therapy applied, but were truly astounded with the results. He had brought this person back from the brink of suicide. We are very grateful for the therapy given by Jor to a serious situation to which we found ourselves ill-equipped to handle. The person in question was back to work the following day and hasn't looked back. Can you explain what you actually done for that person on that day and how distressed they were?
It's great that you've brought this up, actually, Tim, to be honest. And I'm grateful for that because it's a very, very important topic.
Yeah.
And I was actually on site on a major pharmaceutical plant in Cork. There were several hundred men on it, okay? And I'd given several talks over 3 days, several talks a day to hundreds of construction workers on mental health and well-being. And the feedback I was getting was absolutely profound. Now, I was working on site, but I was trying to promote myself as a speaker at the time to go to construction sites and companies to speak about what I do and the benefits of what I do, how I could instill it in people that could make a big difference in their lives.
Mm.
So I'd given the talks and the company were aware that of what I had done, and I was back working on site. I was in my gear, PPS and everything, right? And I got a phone call off one of the directors from the company, and I went into the guys, and the two of them were very, very shook. They met me at the door and they said, "We've a serious situation here. He wants to take his own life. This gentleman, let's call him John, not his real name," and we'd become really good friends after this. And I went in and this guy was literally on his knees. He was traumatised. He was in bits. He was crying uncontrollably. "Now, lads, I don't care how tough you are. Now, obviously, I had to compose myself. But when you look at another human being, especially a grown man, and he's literally on his hands and knees, and he's in bits, it's a tough one.
Mm.
Not to pull on your heartstrings. I'll tell you that now for nothing, okay? Now, to witness that, everything starts to go through your mind. But I know what I was doing. I'm trained at this. So I went in, three of us were in the room then at this point, and they said, "Will you be able to sort this out here? Will we get onto this company and that company and get somebody?" I said, "You can do whatever you want." They said, "This needs to be addressed now," because he was saying that, as I was talking to those guys, "I want to take my own life." And I went over and I just put my hand on his shoulder and I said, "What's your name, bud?" He told me his name. I said, "Look, I can help you this morning," I said, "if you allow me to." And he just nodded. So I said, "I'll take care of this," to the two lads. And they said, "You're anything you need, just come out to us," whatever. So I spent 3.5 hours with him inside in the room. And I performed EFT on him, with him. We spoke about lots of things. Now, what I'm going to say here, okay, is anybody can go through something like this in their lives. And what happened with this gentleman was there was a culmination of many factors over many situations, circumstances and events, mostly negative, in his past life that had brought him to his knees, okay? Now, this could have happened on an aeroplane. It could have happened in Marbella on his holidays, walking down Patrick Street. It hit him like a ton of bricks, okay? The volcano erupted, just couldn't take any more. So the culmination of many factors came up and he broke down uncontrollably. So we spoke about many things that had happened in his life an awful lot of trauma, and we dealt with every single thing that came up in those 3.5 hours. And he was perfect after that. Mm-hmm. So I went out and I asked the two guys to come in, and when they came in, then there's, and it's not like when I'm talking about this story, lads, there's no ego here or nothing. I'm just telling you a story, you know what I mean? And I was just so happy that I was able to help him, but the two lads just couldn't believe the difference in him, you know? And he gave me a big hug, and there was no more crying, and it stopped, and he was back in work the following day.
What was actually going on for him in terms of the physical side, right? We just spoke about the trauma.
Mm-hmm.
He had a lot of energy, obviously trapped within his emotional state.
Yeah.
And you were able to work in him and to get him to talking and for him to connect with his subconscious and tap and just for him to release that trapped energy that's given him so much problems and not allowing him to continue with his life in the best way he can and should.
Absolutely.
Their children had been trafficked in Ireland in the 50s and 60s and even the 70s to Americans and Australians. So I think there must have been good stories amidst all that. There must have been kindly people.
Of course.
Because I'm convinced that 90% of human beings are, ultimately kind, decent, and want to do the right thing, inverted commas.
Yeah.
And you were saying off camera that your mother was from Summerhill.
My grandmother.
Your grandmother.
Yeah.
From inner city.
Yeah.
And it's not that your mother wanted to give you up. It was just at that time, if you weren't married, this was the dilemma you were put into.
Yes. My mother was my father's secretary.
Yeah.
And in fact, from what I can work out, her parents were probably the most ferociously reacting to what happened.
Mm.
And I think she was kind of ostracized. I don't really know the facts, but I gather her mother was absolutely appalled. Her father was appalled.
Because the shame of it.
The shame of the whole thing in Ranelagh in Dublin, and it was where she grew up. And my grandmother was a difficult woman anyway, you know, and I often say in the book, you know, difficulty makes people difficult. You know, I think that's a very important idea for a Samaritan like me, you know, before you leap to judgment, remember where people are coming from. You know, my own grandmother had come from the tenements in Gardiner Street in Dublin at the turn of the last century. Her father was a veteran of the Crimea, the Indian Army, Khartoum. And I'm certain he had post-traumatic stress disorder and was an over-drinking military vet. And I believe he tried to throw her down the stairs, that kind of thing in the tenements. So it was all kicking off. And I'm sure there was terrible poverty. This was the stuff of Sean O'Casey and, you know, the Plough and the Stars. I often think that those plays must have described what my grandmother grew up in, because they actually recognised Sean O'Casey. My mother remembers her mother saying, "Look, there's Mr. O'Casey there." You know, they'd see him in a shop in the area.
It would be like Norfolk Cork people and people not from Dublin. If you think of you know, the Western Road, where you have old houses, you know, maybe 3 or 4 stories high. But if you think of those buildings, and in each room there's a separate family with all the kids, and they all share that big house, that's kind of what the tenements used to be like.
The tenements were once upon a time the homes of the aristocracy and the members of Parliament for Dublin and the country. They were like the great houses of Knightsbridge and Chelsea. And when the Act of Union of about 1800 came in, all of them decamped to London, and the houses fell into dereliction, and they had kind of rack rent landlords. And as you say, they used to put whole families into individual rooms, like a room that would have been a dressing room or a parlour or something, suddenly became a home for 8, 9, 10 people. It's astounding sort of stuff. Mm. And you see pictures, and I remember actually them from the 60s and 70s in Dublin myself as a boy, York Street, beside the College of Surgeons now. I remember the lines and the laundry hanging out of the windows and the barefoot kids wandering around, you know, Moore Street. I mean, there was a great number of slums and tenements in Dublin in the 60s and 70s when I grew up. Mm. And the women in the Barrows and Moore Street and right down Henry Street, they were incredibly poor people. They were the last generation of those slum dwellers. Mm. So my grandmother grew up in that kind of context. And I suspect that she never wanted to look back at all that, and that's why she was so difficult.
Yeah. How does a guy that grew up in that kind of situation in an orphanage go on then to study medicine?
Well, we're going to find out now, aren't we?
Listening to your backstory, I'm sitting here like, and you're a doctor and everything else, and
because there might be a perception that
see where we come from,
consultants and doctors are
that is the beginning of life for a lot of us, homes and things like that, and we go on into prisons and drug addiction. But your story is so different, you know.
Well, here's the thing, Tim. I believe I was the blessed recipient of good luck. You have to remember that the whole of Irish society was in these orphanages, from the very top to the very bottom.
Okay.
So you had letter fracks, yeah? These terrible places where boys were brutalised and killed, or Bessborough, and people, or Tuam, right? And babies ending up in pits you know. And then on the other end, you had people in the upper middle classes where there was still scandal and shame. And they were put into slightly more middle class places. So from what I understand and have learned more and more is that, you know, there were lots of children that were put in and out of these orphanages, inverted commas orphanages, because I don't think that most of the kids in there were orphans. I think most of them were taken from their children, from their mothers.
They weren't
and
handed
fathers.
Up. Like.
So they weren't actually orphans. That's another thing you have to remember. They were often trafficked to childless couples in America or Australia or Britain. Or even Ireland, you know? There were middle-class families in Ireland, I think, who got some of these children as orphans, but they weren't orphans.
Unlike a lot of the people, kids that you would have been in the orphanage with, you ended up back with your mum.
Yeah, because my mother was... See, one of the other things, because one of the other lucky things was my mother was 40 when she had me, which was unbelievably unusual. Like, nowadays, it's very common for women to have their first child at 35. That's quite normal now. But back then, people would have been in their late teens, early 20s, having children. So my mother was 20 years older than most mothers, something which I felt throughout my life, actually, interesting, because my mother was kind of an elderly woman, I thought. I always thought she was very elderly.
Yeah.
And that was a kind of source of grief to me, because all the other mothers seemed to be young and glamorous.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, my mother was really experienced and worldly wise. So she'd worked for years. She was a single working mother. She knew what was going on. So I think, and she had friends and connections. So even though there was a lot of scandal and shame, she had enough friends and support at work. And she was working in Guinness, you know, and Guinness was at one point, I believe, the biggest employer in Dublin. At least it was said, legend had it that in around about 1900, that about a quarter of the entire population of Dublin relied on a Dublin income.
Now,
that doesn't mean that they were all working for it, but it just meant that if you had one member of the family in Guinness, such was the benevolence of Guinness, they were such a great employer, that three, four, five other people could live off that income.
Timmy alluded to there as well. You know, you had a tremendous amount of tragedy with the passing of your two kids. Yeah. You know, if not for people that are watching that would be able to have been through similar experiences, what kind of kept you going, or what did you do to kind of try to move past it? And, you know, was there any kind of, was it exercise, family, friends?
Yeah, I just said, look, first of all, I'd say I've always been very reluctant to talk about it because we've kept it private as a family.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I found it very difficult in the beginning anyway, to be honest, without getting into difficulty very quickly for talking about it, because we lost Rory at 5 weeks from the cot death in 1999, and then Lena with a heart condition in 2010. Yeah. But I have learned of late that people do respond to what did you do kind of thing, and we all share the same experiences, actually. That's what you learn. So recently I did do an article with Jen Hogan in the Irish Times, which I didn't expect a response.
Yeah.
And it mainly was from people who've gone through similar traumas. And just to answer your question, really, it takes time, first of all. The immediate period afterwards is awful, you know. But we had two kids at the time when Rory died. And I always say they pulled us through, because you have to get up. You simply have to get up, get them breakfast, play with them. You know, and therefore, and I remember at the time I was in Ministry of Education, and I was didn't know what I was going to do, you know, because it's a jolt. It undermines all your certainties in life. So I think exercise, you said it there, is very important. And I often wonder, you know, I'm kind of, people laugh at me, you know, because I walk so fast, you know, and they can't keep up. And
Mary's laughing.
there was a funny episode during COP26. The climate change conference in Glasgow, and like the British security force, they've got two policemen kind of following you, like, and so I get out of the hotel and I just literally go for it, you know, or somewhere else, and I just literally down the road because I want to get mad for the exercise. Yeah, father had that 2 years ago. Yeah. And the man apparently is chasing after me. And by the time he gets to the hotel room, like, he's gone, like, he's in deep trouble. So I think the walking is the key to me, and I read that too subsequently, that you do need to get out. Nature is a great healer.
It is.
Yeah. And I love walking, and I walk with friends now, we and it keeps you fit as well. Work is important, getting back to routine. A good friend of mine, Charlie O'Connor, who was a TD and councillor some years back, he lost his son. And I remember going up to him and we had a chat. I just said, Charlie, like, it was in the middle of the last local elections, and he was one. I said, just don't canvass for anybody. The people will vote you in, but you probably need that council experience later on. You'll need routine in your life.
Yeah.
Now, it sounds very boring, but you do need routine. Yeah. Mm-hmm. and getting back to some order, and you keep going. It never goes away.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You'll never forget, but you just... You've got to pick yourself up in life.
You have to give yourself time to give that grieving process a bit of time.
You do, Mary would say, you know, every person will approach it a bit differently.
Yeah.
There's no kind of model to say to people, this is how you cope. You know, there's coping mechanisms that will work for some people that won't work for others.
I think in any type of recovery, whether it be recovering from a traumatic event like that, or recovering from addiction or child abuse or whatever like that, having a bit of structure to your day can only help you, you know, because it does keep you busy, gives you something to get up for. But at the same time, there's no harm in just lying there too, if that's what you need to do on that day. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, don't judge, like, people be at home and they feel like, oh, but I can't. Don't judge yourself. Don't be too hard on yourself. Give yourself a break and allow yourself time, you know?
Yeah.
And a big part of this podcast is around, like, people, like, sharing, you know, hardships and how they've come through, you know, because it does inspire others and does give hope.
And I think it's okay to cry, like. We keep need to tell people that, like, and don't bottle it up, you know. Like, I was lucky. I think our families were fantastic. My brothers, sisters-in-laws, they were superb. They gave us great support and community.
Yeah.
Friends, like, you know, they all rallied, and that helps. Like, there's no doubt about that, you know.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant.
Quick story. I remember my mother was after dying when I was in the Midlands prison. You know, she died by suicide, and I was inside, and I was in an awful state at the time. I wasn't long off alcohol and drugs, and this will tell you know how trauma informed they are inside there. I was in a bad way, you know, I had a lot of guilt and stuff. I was about 9, 10 months away from alcohol and drugs, and my relationship at the time, my mother wasn't great because I was going through a lot of therapy in the prison related to my own trauma as a child. And the prison officer comes up to me and I was in bits and he says, "Will you have to get over and stop crying?" I looked at him and I had a talk in my throat, you know, from crying, like, and I just, like, what the fuck? I can't, I said to him, because I was so traumatized. I just said, I can't, I really can't. And it just brought me back when you were saying, like, crying is the most important.
That's the old school way, isn't it?
And it helped me so much, like, that period, like, just crying in the cell. Helped me.
That must have been an extraordinary experience for you, though.
Unbelievable.
To be in prison when that happened, like.
Yeah, and to be going through early recovery as well. Yeah, you know, I was going through a lot of difficulties as well. I had a lot of shame and guilt as well from my actions during my time. I was involved in drinking drugs and crime and stuff like that. And like, that's one thing you do get when you stop that lifestyle, is you get a massive conscience. And I'd be a sensitive person as well. And all that stuff just came back. I just had a lot of, you know, there's a lot of shame around a lot of the stuff, but that's what happened. And after a while, I would have had this fighter mentality because of my upbringing, you know, having to fight and, you know, being the oldest and being, my mother being a single parent, I had a, and I couldn't surrender into the way I was feeling and just accept the way I was feeling, you know, because you can't cry, you have to be a hard boy, you know, if someone sees you, you'll be vulnerable, they'll take advantage of you. And after a while, it took me a long time, Naomi Hall, to really surrender and just stop, and through years of meditation, and just, it's okay to feel the way you feel, you know, and it's okay to cry.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's just a little bit of a story.
Thank you. I needed to share that.
One of the good things about COVID is in prisons, they have access to the internet now, true, because the video calls and the visits, but they can get YouTube in the prison cell. And our podcast is streamed into the prison cells.
Was it?
And we've recorded a couple of podcasts in Limerick Prison with a female in the library, and with a traveller guy in Cork Prison in the school. And we're doing a part of a series with prisoners, you know what I mean? So, the idea that Timmy can come from that lifestyle and I can come from, you know, addiction and prison like that, but that you can actually go on and still do good things in your life when you get out with the right supports, the level fives, the level threes that you do, the junior sort, these are all beneficial, and they help you for when you grow. So anybody can, you know, you can go through traumas like what you've been through, you know, with the passing your kids, Timmy with his mother. But we can get through them. It's not the end of the world, you know.
I think the fact that you can give a pathway to people, you can show them, you know,
a very achievable pathway as well.
Very achievable pathway, exactly.
But I won't keep it for too long more. Right. But just wanted to finish up on, since you went to politics, no, I'm not giving you all the credit now, but. There's after been a tremendous amount of change in Irish society since the mid-80s to where we are now in 2022. If you were to look back and you were to pick maybe three or four, you know, of the biggest achievements as of Ireland, as opposed to Micheál Martin and Fianna Fáil, but I would probably say the smoking ban is probably one of them. You know, the same-sex marriage would probably be another. But there's after been so many, isn't there?
There has, and I look at it a bigger level. I'd say, first of all, the fact that we're all living longer.
Yeah,
we stand back from it. Irish people were dying too young in the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s. Like road accidents, I was looking at a statistic in that book. I think there was about 458 in 98 dying on roads. It's down to below 130. Still too many.
Yeah.
Do you know? Yeah. So that whole thing around that sort of health outcomes, apparently from hospitals and that, but standing back, we're living healthier and we're living longer.
Yeah.
Like, and that's what we need to keep at.
We're taller.
I think we're much more tolerant and liberal as a people. And I think the Eighth Amendment and the marriage equality has taught us that. That whole idea of diversity, and there's difference and you must tolerate difference. And when you look at what's going on in some countries, authoritarian countries now, like I agree with Biden, I think it is that the struggle in the modern era is authoritarianism versus democracy and old-fashioned values of freedom of speech and all of that. That's where I think the big battleground is, like.
Yeah.
And we, in the country here, we have something good going here, and we need to keep that going.
Yeah.
And what I worry about at times is there can be intolerances develop. Even those who think they're modern attack, through an over exuberance of sort of political correctness to say you can't say that. We need to be tolerant of people. Like, people who make mistakes in their lives.
You hear where that all went. You know, when you look at your prejudice and look at your hang-ups, even though you might feel ashamed of them, they just leave you go, like, you're just gone then. And, you know, these days, whether a guy or a woman rings up, it makes no odds. We're not surprised, you know. The majority who come in are women and are young women, but there's still quite a lot of men coming in, especially after COVID, where you'd have maybe men in their 40s, 50s who might have been abused as children, who are hardworking men who used to being busy and now they're wedding busy and they're going off their game and remembering stuff that happened, you know.
How do you deal with that then when it's a man, you know, as being a female? How do you deal with a man coming in saying that he's after been raped 20 years ago? How do you comfort him? Do you have a male within the...
And a lot of them want women because they've been abused by a guy.
Okay.
I mean, we do have really, you know, good male counsellors outside who we can refer to if that's what they want, but a lot of them at this start want to talk to women. And sometimes, you know, very few people want to go back into detail about what happened or back into remembering every bit of it. And that's the fear, I think, that if they come in, they'll have to go way back into it. But they don't. It's just about how it affects them, how they can move on. And the two big things that keeps them stuck is feeling guilt and feeling shame. You know, the guilt would be, I shouldn't have done this, I should have done things differently, or the shame would be maybe what the abuser said when they're raping them, you know, you really like this, or you really love it, or you really want it. Or say when children are abused, you could have a young girl who, she could only be 6 or 7, you know, And he gives her toys, or he gives her bracelets, or he gives her a comic, and she nearly feels when she grew up like she prostituted herself.
Yeah.
And it's kind of different for guys, because they nearly feel worse in a different way. Because I remember one of the counts was saying about one guy that was in, and she really felt there was still something he wasn't saying. Like, he'd done a lot of stuff, and he came in because, like, say a girl will come in because she'd say, I've married a lovely guy, I really want to be with him, but I can't be close, even though he's nothing like the abuser. She's stuck there somewhere. So we help her kind of around her relationship, her intimacy, that kind of a thing. And I remember he was saying he had a lovely relationship, and then he had a child, and he was afraid to touch the child in case he'd become an abuser, because you have this myth, this bullshit that goes around that if you're abused, then you would be an abuser, and that's rubbish. Like, he had no traits of abusing. And what happened when he was young, the abusers know what they're doing. They know how to get bodies to react to things. So I suppose this young guy, when he's a boy, was getting aroused. So when he looked back, he said, sure, I was aroused, therefore I was taking part in it.
Yeah.
And he was a child. So, you know, the way your head, you get mixed up in your head about, because the abuser will mix you up in your head. He will say it's your fault. He will say you're bold. He will say you're evil. They don't even have to threaten you. They just... No, they just know. You know, they just do it.
And
that's how you help one guy, by kind of helping him really work through it, really, who is the abuser here? And he left feeling so free that he was able to bath his daughter and enjoy time and whatever. And that's what I mean. If you can help people with the guilt and the shame, that's it.
And that's all he probably wanted from life.
I think that's all he wanted. They want,
Yeah.
Did you ever watch The Keepers on Netflix? It's a documentary about, it's an Irish-American school. I think it's in Baltimore.
Yeah.
But one of the girls was being abused, but she orgasmed when she was only a child now.
Exactly.
And she grew up then believing like that she brought it on herself, and that, but like, it really messed up her head later in life. But like, she didn't know what was going on in her body. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
But the manipulation was very deep. And it just kind of, remember when you said it there, that guy got aroused, and how that might mess with your head later in life.
Yeah, and they know how to do it. Like, the abusers know how to do it. And then, you know, in sexual abuse, one thing I will find over the years, Ireland, we were great for covering things up. Like, you know, I mean, I find the years in the centre is about uncovering. It's uncovering, like, say, back then it was rape of girls. So we only thought about bringing people to court and accompanying them that way. And then I think in 1984, the first person came in who had been abused as a child. And then there was a States of Fear programme that opened up all the institutional abuse of boys in institutions and girls in different places. And then, you know, lately we're kind of more involved in working with people who've been trafficked for sexual exploitation in Ireland. So it's all the time uncovering stuff. But at least Ireland is uncovering it. We need to do more. But back then it wouldn't have been covered. It would have been covered up. So that does give me hope.
Mm.
You know, things are being opened up a bit more.
Yeah. We had Dr. Bessel van der Kolk on the podcast last week, and he wrote a book around how the body responds to trauma. And in his book, he talks about people who've been sexually abused as children later in life finding it hard to be intimate. But he gives this example of, he names her Marilyn in the book.
Mm.
Marilyn finds it very difficult to have relationships.
Mm.
So she was going out with this guy anyway, and things were going great. They went back to her house. They did nothing now. But they slept together, and she woke up in the middle of the night, and he was asleep, but he turned around and touched off her, innocuous now, and she lost the plot and attacked him. But he was saying, like, in traumatised people, the body doesn't understand the difference between something like that and danger, and it just reacts as if it's danger. And even internally, the body can, you know, see an innocuous event like that and attack its own body as well, and it kind of manifests in a chronic illness, you know. But very difficult to work through, and I'm sure you come across it a lot.
Yeah, because the body does remember. Even like, you know, you could have somebody who's been raped, and then she might be starting to go out again, and she might be in a place which is nothing like where, you know, the event happened, and all of a sudden she gets a panic attack, and her body kind of remembering there's some kind of danger there. And then sometimes they think they're losing it. So that's kind of where we can help them out and support them, and, you know, showing them, like you say, really something physically, even showing them how the mind and body works. It's not always about how you're feeling, because you feel shit.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, I've no time for spending hours and hours of people just going around in that cycle. If there's some way of showing them, well, we know you feel really awful, But this is another side of it that you can't control. This is how your body's reacting. Sometimes that can be a massive relief for people that they think they're not going mad, you know.
So Gabor's piece is compassionate inquiry. So that's a lot of Gabor's work is about coming into the body and kind of like you're saying there, noticing not just the story, because that's in our heads, but what's the emotional reaction? What do you notice in your body? So, you know, someone might come in and say, you know, I'm really triggered by my partner and they're driving me daft. And very quickly, Gabor will ask them to come into the body and notice what's happening for you. So I notice my chest is tight, my breath is shallow and my tummy's kind of wrenching. And he might ask them, what's the emotion behind that? And say, oh, I feel sad or I feel angry. So it's about going below the story, as you say, because we can get caught up in these narratives and just going round in circles and judgments and sort of just caught in the head and leaving the body. And, you know, it's not directly Gabor related, but my belief is that our emotions are a collection of physical sensations in the body. So again, fear maybe is tightness in the chest, constriction in my throat. It's different all the time. But I give it a name. So I say I'm fearful or I'm scared. And then I go to my head to try and figure out how I'm scared and how I can not be scared. So I've gone from my body to my head and I've left my body basically and I'm living in my head. Sometimes all the fear needs is just a bit of space to like take a couple of breaths in that place, allow it to be where it is rather than pushing it down. You know, a lot of emotional suppression. And then maybe working with the fear, again, staying out of the head and asking that fearful part of me, what do you want me to know? If you had a voice, what would you say? So Gabor's stuff kind of ties in with that, linking the body and mind, seeing again, the body keeps the score. You know, we hear this language, but it's very true. And then going back to your youth and recognizing that any of the beliefs that we hold, particularly inner critic, that's a lot of inner child stuff usually. The things we tell ourselves about ourselves that we don't like. I don't fit in. I'm not enough. I'll never be enough. Generally, we heard that somewhere along the line and internalized it.
The first time I've ever heard of inner critic and the inner child was when I was in the treatment center in Carlow in 2013 in St. Francis Farm. And we got a seminar from one of the counselors. He used to do seminars every Friday afternoon. You know, you'd have a lot of intense groups Monday to Friday, but on a Friday afternoon it was like cup of tea seminar. It was usually entertaining, but it was on transactional analysis, which is a theory by Eric Byrne, psychologist. Blind Boy did two good podcasts on transactional analysis, and he really explains it way better than I'm going to. But basically it was like we respond to things from three different levels, the critical parent or the afraid child or the adult, right? And we go around, you know, like to go about your day-to-day business, you need to be in your adult side of your brain, you know? Because like if you go into work, right? And you've an authoritative boss or a strict boss or a cranky boss and he starts talking, don't you, giving out you, if you go into that child, you can throw a tantrum or something like that. Do you know what I mean? So like if he's in the critical parent and you go into the scared child or the tantrum child, that's not going to work. So if he's there, you have to try and stay at that level, say, and we go about HR route or we go about it that way, you know. But the best example I can give, like, it's grand being in the adult mode when you're in work, but you know, if you go home for Christmas dinner, right, and you have to do all this personal development, and you're like, right, I have to do my EMDR, all these trainings, I'm not going to get caught up in the dynamics at home. But you know, as soon as you open that door, go in and sit down at that kitchen table, your sister is next to you, your brother is there, your mum is there, your dad is there, you will go into that role of the tantrum child, and she'll go into the role of the strict parent, and you've no control over her, and it's only afterwards when you leave, you're like, fucking hell, do you know what I mean? But that's basic response, you know. But the inner critic was the point I wanted to talk about. Was I thought about inner critic, and the inner critic I thought was just me, was just like that was who I was. Do you know, don't take off your jacket, everybody's going to look at you, look at the stadia, don't be talking, you're not even going to be able to speak. Do you know, that's what I thought I was. But when I heard that, that's the inner critic, and you can get control over that, that was huge for me, because then I began to think, like, that's just a part of me, but that's not who I am. Do you know what I mean?
And then just
it's not even a, it's actually not even a part of who you are.
But you know, when in addiction,
it's conditioning.
When you've been bullied or when you're in addiction and all that stigma and stuff like that, that's a very loud part there.
Yeah.
But as you get a little bit better in yourself, you can get a kind of more control over, can't you?
It's about noticing, isn't it, Pat?
Yeah, and I think another piece that I've learned is, you know, we can have a tendency to want to get rid of these parts because we say, Jesus, this is holding me back. And so we try to almost cut off a part of ourselves, when in reality, it's about welcoming them back and kind of getting to know them. So asking my inner critic, what are you afraid is going to happen if you disappear? And they might say, well, geez, you're going to push yourself out there, Pat, and people could make fun of you. Okay, that makes sense. That's why you're keeping me back a little bit. Is there a way I can make you feel safe? And I'll speak to that part to myself. And they say, okay, well, maybe take off your jacket and just go up the room and put it back on if you feel comfortable. So I think it's almost negotiating with ourselves. And just another quick piece on you mentioning like the different parts, the wounded part, the wounded child or the adult. Or what's been really interesting for me the last couple of months in studying is, again, this mind-body connection, is that when we're in a stress state, when I'm experiencing stress in my body, so fast heart rate, shallow breath, tension in my muscles, when I'm picking up cues of danger, and that could be anything from my ex walking into the room to a smell of smoke and thinking there's a fire. Anytime my body feels stressed, positive thinking is almost a waste of time because the body is informing my mind that we're in trouble here. So to get into that adult part, I have to come into my body first, wasting my time trying to think myself positive. We've tried to outthink anxiety. So slow breathing, feeling my feet on the ground, looking around me for signs of safety. And when I'm safe in my body, my mind can go open, you know.
There's something about us that the addict doesn't let themselves in on. You know, like I'd be addicted to tobacco. I spent from 18 to about 33 or so smoking tobacco. So I really know about addiction from that. And I know how easy it was to fool myself into thinking, sure, I'm not addicted at all, or sure, it's okay, what am I doing? Just having a cigarette. And that's present in all addiction, I think. There's a part of us that doesn't really wake up to the full reality of addiction. We keep kind of making excuses about it, or letting ourselves off the hook about it, or minimizing it, and all the things we used to call denial. And people don't really see that. Even having been through treatment, people, like the first thing people do after they go out of treatment in some cases is drink or use drugs. Relapse, we call it, And it's because they still haven't got the full picture. They still haven't seen that there's something about the addiction will live on in them and will keep prodding at them and suggesting to them, it's okay, what's the problem?
It's called stinking thinking, I learned.
They call that stinking thinking, that. And so your brain isn't fully in on the picture on what the addiction is really like. And it can take people a lot of doom and gloom before they wake up to that, as they call it, an awakening in the 12-step fellowship.
And multiple attempts at it as well. Like
multiple attempts.
Multiple treatment centers, multiple sponsors. And very rarely would you just, in my experience, would people just go to treatment and then that's it. There's no hiccups along the way. Nearly everybody wants to test the water again. I'll be able to use differently this time.
Yeah.
Do you know, another very important factor around that relapse period is as well, if your thinking starts to tell you, right, that you should go back out, and this works across the board with every addiction, it was very easy to give it up this time. This is the we'll give it up again. Just go back out for another day or two and you'll be grand, and we'll give it up again and we'll be fine.
That's right.
That's a part of that process where the mind comes at you. It's so conniving. The mind, I was at that period now, just the day I was going into prison, my mind was telling me, sure, go in and get a load of drugs before you go in. And like, I was saying, no one answered the phone anyway, thankfully. But it wasn't until afterwards I realized it was the same form of thinking, because I said, I go in, I get stoned and I come back off it again. You know, that was never going to happen. I go in there, I get stoned and I continue.
The problem is when sometimes people go back out there and they never come back.
They don't come back.
They might die of an overdose, or they might just live on miserably and might find it very hard to get back. So the shame of it all. But how has Table Lodge evolved over the last 25 years that you've been there for?
Big Evolutions have been the whole secondary treatment programs, you know, the fellowship houses and renewals, where we're realizing that 4 weeks wasn't long enough for a lot of clients, especially the younger ones and the ones who were, you know, what we call polyaddicted or had multiple addictions and had all sorts of other challenges, like education hadn't been a success, hadn't been good training for employment, hadn't been good employment opportunities, coping maybe with family of origins, addictions or other kind of traumatic events that that impaired their ability to cope with life successfully on a day-to-day basis. And we call them complex needs now when we look at the national protocols for drug and alcohol services and you're looking at a comprehensive assessment. You've got 10 fields or whatever it is where you're getting a picture of what every different part of a person's life is like. And as we, as time went on, we realized, gosh, these people have huge needs in many areas of their lives. And what's the point in giving someone 28 days of treatment in Tabor Lodge and then sending them back to very precarious accommodation situations or sending them back into a family where there's alcoholism that is active and or sending them back into an area where the local culture is for a lot of alcohol to be consumed or a lot of drugs to be available. Yeah. So we had to start developing longer treatment options for people and also seeing treatment as a kind of a stepping stone toward more independent living for people.
I'm in the bedroom and they went out and she called me down as wife and she said they're going out to batter some fella. That was standard. That was yeah. Weekly things. I mean, that wasn't anything that you'd be like sitting there shocked because that happened to me all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But when they came back and had me, I'd seen guns. But I'd be hiding the guns in the field. They'd be telling me, hide this, hide that. Like the field was full of heroin, full of money, full of guns, full of cars, full of bikes, it was everything you name it was in them fields. I knew them fields like the back of my hand. I was in them fields at 2, 3, 4, 5 in the morning with torches on my head, with infrared goggles, with a dog with me, sometimes by myself in the lashing, the rain, freezing cold, he'd send you out. And that's what you had to do. And I'd done it, I'd done all that stuff, but when he came back after, handed me the gun and told me to run up to the field and hide it, I knew there was something. I knew there was something bad after happening. But when I came back and they told me what they were after doing, and then it didn't really hit me until they told me to check the teletext. And then when I checked the teletext and it says a man has been shot dead outside Cloverhill Prison. And he says to me, shout without reader. Kenny said, shout without reader because Thomas can't read. So I shout without reader and I said, it didn't say he died first. At first it said a man has been shot outside Cloverhill Prison.
Mm.
And then they were panicking. Saying, what if he's not dead? What if he's not dead? And then I checked another teletext. There was only two. There was RTE and TV3 at the time. And then I checked the other one. I think it was TV3. I might have been called something else, but it was 3. It was definitely the 3 channel. And I said, a man has died outside Cloverhill Prison after being shot. And they were bouncing around the kitchen, clapping, high-fiving, cheering, whacking Jack Daniels over, smoking gear on the foil, sniffing lines of coke. Then they brought me in and started threatening me, telling me if I told anybody what they do to me, what they do to my family. I was terrified, like, and I'm not going to sit here and say I wasn't, because I was.
Mm.
And then they gave me the gear, the letters, and told me to chop them up and burn them in the stove. And then I wasn't doing that right. You'd be shouting, you're doing it wrong, so-and-so. But then after that, everything got so worse because what he was timing me. He brought me to the field and he had a pump action shotgun and he used to make me stand in the field and shoot beside my head or shoot over me. It's not to make me scared, just to show me, like, and then he keeps saying, look, I've done it once and I'll do it again. And then the abuse got worse. Like, he kept bringing me down to the shed and beating me and abusing me more, and it just got, everything got so much, it was like he was obsessed with me. Because he told me, it was like he got obsessed with me then. Like, what he would do is, he'd bring me out in the car, and he would time the garage. There was a garage up the back of Roadstone, and he would time me from the house with him driving to the garage and back, and then he would say to me, so that took me, say, 7 or 8 minutes. So when he said to me, go out and come back, and if I'm not back in that 7 or 8 minutes, as soon as you go in, like, you're getting a sore all across your back or a dig in the face, like, because he'd have to time it. Everything was time because he thought I was telling people stuff.
Mm.
He was getting paranoid, the drugs were. He was freaked, like, because he had murdered a man, he kept thinking I was going to tell somebody, like. And I just couldn't take it anymore.
What was the timeline between the murder and you having to go into the guards at this stage?
I think about 3 weeks.
3 weeks.
What happened? I couldn't get away, like,
yeah.
Who do I go to?
Yeah.
How do I go to the guards? And I was afraid they were going to ring him and say, well, we have him down here saying you murdered somebody. Then I was dead, like. But the only smart thing I done was when I hid the gun, I never told him where I hid the gun.
Mm.
And that was the only smart thing I ever done, because I don't know what, subconsciously I must have just, it wasn't like I planned it. I always hid there was three fields, and I hid the smack and the money in one field and the guns in the other field. But for this one time, for some reason, I went to the third field and I put the murder weapon in the third field.
Mm.
Something in me just told me just to hide it there. Like, I don't know why I hid
Can
it.
Can you
there.
Remember that murder, Nicola, when it happened? Were you reporting on that?
Yeah, I remember. I don't remember it sort of significantly.
Yeah.
I had no intimacy with it or whatever.
But the fact it was right outside the prison stands out, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And then the trial was the fact that, obviously, when it came to trial, Joey subsequently did escape that home, and he went to the police and he brought them and they found the murder weapon. You asked how much money he was making, Kenny, at the time, Brian Kenny. I think there was about 200 or 50,000 found buried in the fields alone opposite the house. He was making a huge amount of money. Joey went on to give evidence against both him and Thomas Hinchin, and they were convicted of murder. It was before a jury, and they were convicted of murder and sent away. So that was significant because he was the youngest state witness to give evidence like that. You know, they're in protection. Obviously, they go into witness protection once they give their evidence. They're signed out of witness protection and they're sent off into the world alone. Mm. That's fine for an older individual with family maybe around them.
Yeah.
But Joey was so young and without all those skills that you maybe learn before you go out into the world just alone.
The child, basically. He said it there himself. He was obviously just a child because he never had an opportunity to grow and to become the person that he was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody was minding you. Like, you know, you think of like Timmy's 11-year-old. There's nobody minding him. There's nobody playing with you. You don't experience like sport or girlfriends, boyfriends, or going out. You know, clubs or youth clubs. You know, mountain bikes. You know, stuff that children should be doing.
Mm.
Like, you missed all that part of your life, which is sad. Do you know what I mean? And I think about like what other children out there are experiencing this today. You know. But like, for you to come through it. So when that murder happened, you know, when it was really bad, it was bad now the whole way, but like when things got intense in terms of his possession of you, what kind of relationship had you got with your mother at the time? Had you any communication with the family?
No, not really. My ma came up once when I wasn't there. My ma came up to get me back because she hadn't seen me. And I wasn't there.
Mm.
And his partner was there, and my mum was like, I haven't seen Joseph. Is everything all right? And she said, yeah, and whatever. And I wouldn't see my family. It'd be very rarely I'd see them. When I seen them, you played the game. You said everything was all right, and you never said anything. You just lied, like.
Yeah.
And that was the way it was. That was the cycle. You just told them everything was okay, and I'm happy, and I'm up there walking, and I'm making money, and you never... You never said anything. Like, you just...
The fear as well, if you like.
Yeah, because you're thinking of what's going to happen to them. Like, it was like even the night when I went to the police, he turned up at the house like with a big can of petrol outside my house with a lighter off, threatening to burn the house down if I didn't come back. Like, so when I was in the police station, like, he was ringing the phone. He actually was admitting what he'd done on the phone. When I was in the police station, like, I think we met one of the guards that he did in the podcast, Todd. he's the main investigator at the murder, and he'll tell you, like, he was sitting in front of me taking a statement, and Kenny was saying, I want my gun back, and I was, what I'm going to do with you. And then he went to court and said, I'm not guilty.
Yeah.
Do you understand? Yeah. It wasn't like I'm making this stuff up. This stuff was all in, from his phone to my phone. And they weren't turning the phone off. The guards were like, let him keep texting. Like, there was hundreds that just kept ringing and ringing and ringing, and messages and messages. And it was just constant, like, it was...
Did the guards treat you well when you first went to the station?
In the beginning, they were brilliant. I could never have asked for anything more. Like, they were compassionate, and they were... Like, I was skinny, like, I was. You could see my ribs, I was black and blue.
One of the things...
Well, 18, we enjoyed that point.
Yeah. I was fragile, like, I was skinny, I was strung out, like...
Most fellas only kind of break their teeth in the drug game about that age. You know, like, you're already after being there 10 years at this stage, well, 8 years at this stage.
Yeah. A sad image in the book and the podcast is when they raided his house and they went up to your room, and there was the bed, and there was a chair, and there was no toys or magazines or radio, there was nothing there to say that a young person lived in this room, you know. And that was, you know, you had no belongings to take with you, stuff like that. It's a very sad image, you know.
Does that make you feel sad hearing that from someone else?
It didn't at the time. It didn't. I felt embarrassed at the time. I never knew it was
sad.
I didn't know it was sad at the time, but I'll never forget how embarrassed I was when the guard said it to me. When they took me, because what happened is when they took Kenny out of the house, they brought me back. And because they needed to take pictures of me in the house with all the evidence, with the guns, with the money, with the drugs. And they took me up to my room and they says, where's your stuff? And I said, what stuff? And they were like, where's your things? Like, I said, I don't have anything. I just have what I have. That was it.
How do they approach you for witness protection? Like, what kind of conversations do they have? What's the offer they give you in return for your evidence, you know? Do they make false promises, or how do they sell it to you?
But see, there's a difference. There's a couple of ways of witness protection. Most people go to witness protection if the guards have something on them. They say, listen, if you let me off of this, I've done this. If I tell you this and you let me off of this, I'll go to court and give evidence against so-and-so.
Like what's in the courts at the moment? It's that kind of a situation.
Yeah, so...
They're approached.
Yeah.
So that's how it works. Where with me, it was different because I hadn't done anything, and there was no criminal... I hadn't got any criminal convictions. Yeah. I'd been arrested probably, I don't know how many times, but drug searches brought in, drug search, nothing on me. I'd been chased by the police because that's what we were involved in. Like, that's what he had me doing. Like.
I was a quiet young fella. I still am quiet.
Yeah, definitely.
I am quiet. I always was quiet.
Yeah.
But the tablets and the alcohol, you know, I suppose it changed my character, you know what I mean? And I done stuff that I brought up a lot of shame and a lot of guilt. I was out of control, you know.
Yeah.
It was like blanking out. And it was never about, you know, using socially, you know, have a bit of crack. You know, There was a part of that, but it was always using to get flattened.
Mm-hmm.
It was like getting cans, but getting a bottle of porno on the side.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. My dad used to say to me, you're the only man in Cork to wake up in the morning and take 10 sleeping tablets.
that was the way it was back then, though.
And you're around then for the day, complete like a zombie.
Yeah.
But you know what it was? I was quiet and I was shy and I was so insecure. That if I didn't have all them tablets in me, I couldn't function as a human. I couldn't go to the shop. I was brutal around women. Do you know, if I was getting attention from a girl, I wouldn't know how to cope with it unless I was throwing it over my head. And then it's like, you're grand. Do you know what I mean? The tablets gave me everything that I didn't have. Do you know? The confidence, the self-esteem, all this stuff. Do you know, when you're taking Valium and Rohypnol and stuff like that, you don't give a fuck about anything like that. Like,
oh, no.
It's just like, this is who I am, take me or leave me, full of confidence.
and
I always chased that.
Yeah.
I always chased that. And but getting back to the prison thing, up in A3. Oh yeah, I'll go back to the guy that I normally took his car. Okay. Or looking back now,
yeah.
I think it would have been very beneficial if I had to meet that person mm-hmm. across the table like this, and for him to tell me how what my actions had impact on him, mm-hmm. you know, about how he works hard for it. It was his pride and joy. I think that would have had a way more impact on me than the prison sentence, really. Mm-hmm. But we never, like, living in an area like that, like, we didn't have nice cars and we didn't have, you know, nice things like that. Mm-hmm. So we never had any connection with the people that did.
Yeah.
And, like, if we were treated harshly and we treated them harshly in return, that was just the way of the world. And you sometimes you get it and sometimes you receive it. And
I think that's a very, very valuable point what you made there, you know, confronting the person that you hurt.
Yeah.
You know, and it's something that a lot of people do in recovery, you know.
Yeah.
They try to make amends to people that they hurt during their addiction, alcoholism, whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes people accept it, you know, and sometimes people don't accept it, you know. Mm. But you've often said something to me, you know, what you're doing at the moment is one way of making amends to your community and, yeah. and people that you may have came across in your lifetime and yeah. hurt or whatever, you know, and I know you, and I know you'd always, if someone approached you and something happened in the past, I know you'd always, you know, put your hands up and
yeah.
say, listen, I apologize, you know, like myself, you know,
yeah.
which I would have yeah. apologized, like, last week.
Exactly. Yeah. And the guilt and the shame of it all really shows, like, the guilt and the shame showed me that I wasn't, that deep down I was actually a good person. You know, but I was doing things that weren't good,
yeah,
and I was hurting people, and it didn't sit with me at all. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And when I did come into recovery, I was able to go around to some people that I felt, you know, would have been safe for me and safe mm-hmm. for them for it to happen. But sometimes I did things that I probably can't remember, mm-hmm. or sometimes I did things to people that it wouldn't be best for me to mm-hmm. approach them. So then, how do I make amends? It's I do it in a kind of a general way, mm-hmm. you know. I wanted to help people. So I kind of got a job helping people and to do this, you know what I mean? So
yeah.
if there's still people out there that's hurt, I'm wholly apologetic.
Okay.
You know? But just know, like, that I wasn't a cold person,
mm-hmm.
do you know what I mean? Or I'm not a cold person. I was maybe mm-hmm. under the influence of substances and, do you know, but there was a lot of guilt and there's a lot of mm-hmm. regrets there as well. Yeah. You know, you were talking about the football thing.
Yeah.
I lived to play football yeah. when I was a child. But I didn't kick a ball between the ages 16 and 32.
Yeah.
Like, that's 16 years of my life. And now looking back, this is probably the one big regret I have.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I'd played football, and it's not about playing. I'd love to have been played AUL,
mm-hmm.
you know. But just to have a career and the camaraderie and, you know, to get the Turner's Cross, I wish to have played in Turner's Cross, mm-hmm. you know. But I gave up all my good years, my athlete years, let's say, for drinking drugs in prison.
Yeah.
You know, and I in prison, like, I get into the shape of my life. You know, I could go into prison 9 or 10 stone, 7 or 8 weeks down the line, playing handball, weightlifting, playing soccer. I've my family back in my life, you know. I've no debts and I'm drug free. I had a social life because I was mingling with friends in there. I felt more freedom in prison than I did on the street.
Yeah.
Because when I got in the street, I strung out again. No family around me, no friends around me. Nobody wanted to be around me. I didn't want to be around anybody. And chained to a chemist for the methadone, chained to 1 or 2 dealers, chained to the doctor for the script. The highlight of my week was going to the chemist.
Yeah.
You know, a very, very pathetic existence. Mm-hmm. But when I went to prison, all that was gone. And even though I was in a tiny cell with somebody else and a piss pot in the corner,
yeah,
I felt more freedom in there
because
I had my family back. I was safe and I was happy and I was, you know, be able to watch the football on the weekend and go to the gym and, you know, just have a life with people, because addiction was very isolating for me, you know, especially when I moved on. They were good things because they worked at the time.
Yeah, they're wonderful things. These are things we all human beings want. Now, that means that the addiction, it's nonsense to talk about addiction as a disease, because what kind of disease gives you security and comfort and self-esteem and belonging? it's also ridiculous to talk about it as a choice, because who chooses to be insecure and anxious and uncomfortable and isolated and emotionally wrought up? So these are all states of emotional pain. And addiction soothes the pain. So that's my mantra under addiction, is not why the addiction, but why the pain. Now, why the pain? You just told me about your childhoods. You told me that as you were growing up, in your family of origins, things happened to you that robbed you of security, that robbed you of genuine self-esteem, that robbed you of comfort, that robbed you of your God-given right to belong to the human race, that robbed you of confidence. So that's the trauma. The trauma is the loss of all these good qualities that every child should have. And so they're the traumatic events, but the trauma then is the wound that we sustain, that we then keep trying to soothe all our lives. And addictions really are a way of soothing the pain induced by early trauma.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because when I was around 17, 18, I had a suicide attempt. And after that, I found benzodiazepines. And even though I was my life was destroyed on benzodiazepines, and I was going in and out of prison and hospitals, I wasn't trying to kill myself, you know. So in a kind of a paradoxical way, they helped me get over that part of my life where I was suicidal. Then the drugs helped me through it, even though I was, you know, in and out of prison. But it got me through that point in my life.
There's a lot of people who are driven to the point of despair. And as one very famous writer said to me, drugs saved my life.
Yeah.
Then they almost destroyed me. So that's, but initially the addictions, again, to whatever it is, whether it's drugs or behaviors, it comes along to soothe some kind of a deep pain and deep despair. And the source of that deep pain and deep despair is childhood trauma.
Yeah.
I would have been quite similar to James as well, you know. I would have used substances at a really young age. And I can really relate to what that your friend, that author, said. Because when I look back at my own life in hindsight, if I didn't have those substances or drugs in my life to take me away from what was going on inside my head,
yes,
and the feelings and emotions that I was going through that I wasn't able to handle,
yes,
I possibly, looking back now, I don't know what I could say I possibly would have took my own life, because that did come into my mind, but...
Or you might have turned to violence or something desperate, you know. And so a lot of the people listening, if you're in jail, you're being punished for your behaviors, maybe to do with drugs, maybe to do with violence. But what you're really being punished for is how you were wounded as a child and how you weren't given a help to resolve that wound. I'm not saying that people aren't responsible, and we have to be, but we have to understand, for society to be responsible, it means that we have to understand why people behave the way they do, and particularly why they, say, turn to drugs. I've never met anybody addicted to drugs who woke up out of a happy life one Saturday morning and said, hey, my ambition is to become a drug addict. It wasn't like that. It's that people came across the drug and all of a sudden they felt like they've never felt before in their lives, in a positive sense, you know.
Yeah. So
we have to look at the sources of how they were deprived of that positivity earlier in life. And you
I was just going to say, doesn't it just emphasize how pointless an exercise is of sending people in addiction in and out of prison for short sentences for possession?
Well, I'm in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, and in an area called the Downtown East Side, which is really North America's most concentrated area of drug use. I mean, if you walk down into those few square blocks, you see people injecting and inhaling and selling, and you know. And those people, it's like a revolving door. They go in and out of jail. Now, We call the prison system the correctional system, but it doesn't correct anything. It's a punitive system. It's not a correctional system. We also talk about rehabilitation, but very few people ever get rehabilitated because the wound, the trauma that keeps driving their behaviors is never healed. It can be, but neither the medical system nor the legal system understands the need to heal the trauma. And so then it's a revolving door, and people do detox in prison willy or nilly, but then they come out and within a couple of days they use it again. That was my experience. And it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, if you're gonna lock people up, give them the rehabilitation treatment that they actually need. If you think you need to protect society from certain behaviors, well, that might be fair enough. But why be punitive about it? Why not help people really heal? And that can be done. It doesn't need to be done the way we do it. You can protect society, and you can also help people at the same time. And furthermore, it's a bit arbitrary, isn't it? Because if you're like in most countries, say possessing heroin or cocaine is illegal, but possessing alcohol or cigarettes is not illegal, and alcohol and cigarettes kill a lot more people than heroin or cocaine ever do. I'm not saying cocaine or heroin should be sold in the streets or in the corner stores, but I'm saying that there's a real contradiction about the social attitude towards substances. Some substances that are far more lethal in the long term are permitted and profited off by respectable businessmen. Other drugs are forbidden, and people are sent to jail for possessing them. Doesn't make any sense. Mm.
Always caught up in my head. I would have been an introvert person, you know, always kind of inside, always kind of the one looking out at how everybody was, and caught up in my own head as a young child, you know.
So you would have been at a young age, you would have been a deep thinker.
Yes.
And how was school at the time?
School was very, very difficult, you know. There was an awful lot going on at home, and when I was in school, I wasn't able to focus on what the teacher was talking about or anything. And I spent most of my time at the back of the class or outside the principal's office or whatever. You know, it was difficult. And later on, those effects showed, you know.
What were your grades? Were you able to achieve academically in school?
No, there was none. There was no such thing as a grade. I couldn't read or write, basically.
And was there any additional support offered? Or?
No, there was nothing. All there was, I was kind of kept up in the assembly of the school or outside the principal's office, or the end of the back of the class was where I spent most of my time, you know. And that, for a child, in my opinion, when looking back in hindsight now, is probably one of the worst things you could do to a child's confidence and self-esteem and things like that. It really kind of affected me, and it taught me that I was not good enough, you know. And I went through my adult life always believing that I wasn't good enough, you know.
So, you know, when you were going through school then, did you complete your junior cert and leaving cert, or how did that go?
No, there was, when I hit the age of 10, I would have went on the hop from school a lot. People from the area would know Hogan's Lane. I spent a lot of time in Hogan's Lane, you know, and we would have went
Hogan's Lane and Ashes Boring.
Yes, we would have, we were at the pawn shop, selling out to the woman who owns the pawn shop. But we were robbing the old varnish out of her shop and tipbacks and anything that we could get a bit of a stone off.
From a very young age, you were looking for ways to get out of your head.
Yeah. There was a lot going on for me in my own head, James, and I didn't know how to deal with it.
Yeah. So you used the coping skills that's available to you, and at that time it was Tipex, nail varnish, solvents and stuff like that.
Yeah. Like, I grew up in a home where there was a single parent, you know, my mother, and she was unstable. And there's other kids in the school, out in the street then, and they see this, like, there was a lot of bullying, what I'm trying to say, you know. There was a lot of bullying as well, because we didn't have anything, you know. There wasn't a lot of food there, there wasn't much of anything, you know. Clothes, there was a lot of hand-me-downs, you know, and things like that. Yeah. It was like, we grew up in the 80s, James. The 80s were tough times for a lot of families, you know.
And if I can put some context there on Air Cullen, Knocknaheeny, Holly Hill, and even City North West, there would have been housing estates built around 60s, 70s, when there would have been a lot of working class families put up here, maybe employed in Lulham's, Ford's, Dunlop's. And when that industry broke down, a lot of people became unemployed, and maybe the jobs didn't reoccur in the 80s, obviously, with the big recession. So with a lot of big housing estates, maybe limited services at the time, unemployment, that breeds social problems.
Yeah.
So that's the context that you're talking about.
Yeah. It was like, I'm talking about my story and how bad it was for me, but in general, it was bad for everybody. It's just that we had just a single parent and a parent that was unstable, and you know.
Yeah.
No, I just want to say one thing. Like, my mother done everything she could in her own power that she thought was possible for us as kids, you know, and it was just, there were difficult times, you know, for everyone, and, you know, we made the best of it, you know.
Yeah, and I know your mother, you know, I grew up in that house, your mother used to be good friends with my mother, and, you know, I seen her as a lovely lady, very good to me, very good for our sons, but obviously had her own issues and her own difficulties, you know, and everybody, you know, there's a context to everything, do you know what I mean? And there's never anybody to blame. It's just about understanding your story, that's all it is. And kind of looking back and being able to identify what was going on at the time, it helps you then to understand your behaviour and how your outcomes became negative, let's say. So when you finished school, we're talking about there, you created kind of an angry demeanour. Can you tell me more about that?
Well, what I created was this angry look. What it really was a form of protection to keep people away, keep people at distance, because, you know, there was, as I said earlier, there was a lot of bullying and things like that, and it was tough for me emotionally, you know. I struggled as a teenager, you know. I did a lot of shit going on in my life that I didn't understand, you know. There wasn't very much teaching to me growing up as a child. You know, I had to learn everything really for myself, in terms of how to behave and how to everything.
You have the sensations in your body of feeling agitated, feeling scared, something eating away at you. I like to use Darwin's terms, heartbreak and gut wrench. And that's when you experience the sensations. And so you go through life feeling uptight and feeling frozen and feeling agitated, and you want to stay in control. And one great way of getting into control is by taking something that makes those feelings go away. In some ways, becoming a drug addict is not all that different from going to a doctor who prescribes you pills. You just prescribe pills for yourself. If you do it yourself, you're a bad person. If the doctor does it for you, you're a good person. But at the end, the result is the same. These are chemicals that make you feel more capable of inhabiting the body that you live in.
go on, Tim.
You know, a child that has had a traumatic experience, right, and they do go into addiction at whatever age, in their teens or whatever, and they stop. And when they're dealing with the trauma, when they get when they have to deal, they go back into their childhood and they're starting to deal with it. It can be very, very, very difficult for people to handle that. And
it's really important to say that this is very, very difficult. Because first you start off with a lot of trauma that leaves you feeling bad about yourself and bad about your body. And you medicate it with your drugs. And then the drugs are pretty good in pushing your things away. When you get off the drug, all that stuff comes back in greater force than the original stuff. So cleaning yourself up, as you guys have done, is always a major act of heroism almost. Like, I admire everybody who does it because I have some pretty good sense of how extremely difficult it is to deal with all that internal discomfort in your body and that craving and feeling terrible about yourself, feel horrible in your body. It's really hard to become clean, as you guys know.
In your book, I suppose in my experience when I was a young person, I always kind of seeked out dramatic situations like being in stolen cars, being in violent events, you know, ending up in prison and all that chaos and drama. And I know certain people, I work in drug and alcohol service, and I know certain people like that, their lives are full of drama. In your book, you talk about traumatized people feel numb and they seek out drama because it's the only time they actually feel alive. And that resonated with me. Can you elaborate on that a little bit, please?
Yeah, so, you know, when you're traumatized, you do anything to somehow cope and to somehow feel alive. And so one thing you become probably fairly good at is to shut off your sensations in your body, because it's also somatically based. So you work very hard in developing your capacity to not feel. But if you don't feel anything, you don't feel alive. And so you feel like a zombie. And then in order to overcome that capacity to not feel anything, you need to do something that's pretty extreme, where your stress hormones get activated and you go like, I feel alive. So one of the great paradoxes about trauma is that one of the very first things that struck me working with veterans also is that they hated the war, but the only thing that makes them feel alive was doing warlike things. Because then all your chemicals in your body start getting activated and you really become sort of a specialist in dealing with very, very scary situations. So you may, I may become absolutely terrified being chased by the police, and you may go like, wow, how cool is that? People are shooting at me.
Yeah. You spoke about there, dude, did a lot of work with Vietnam veterans. Some who would have committed some terrible acts, but you've helped them to overcome them. Now, some people accessing this podcast might have stuff in their past that they may feel shameful about. But do you believe people have an innate ability to make good and an innate ability to recover?
Well, we do have an innate capacity to recover, but particularly if you have done terrible things, that issue of moral injury is a very, very difficult thing, because at some point, what you have done may be worse even than has been done to you. And so how do you live with yourself knowing that you have done terrible things? It's a very deep spiritual journey also of penitence and of making repairs. So that's the self-step programs. Of course, we're very good at that already, that you need to make repair, you need to acknowledge the reality. And facing what you have done is a tough thing, not only for young male guys who do criminal things, but also for women who have been sexually abused. They may say, this happened to me, I didn't fight back. Or I love the guy who did this to me. And they may actually unwittingly set themselves up for sexual violation, and that because on some level they may think like the only thing that I'm good for is to serve some guy's sexual gratification because I'm no good anyway. So you get these very complex reenactment type situations where most people who haven't been traumatized, they wouldn't want to do that. But if it's what you grew up with, people go back to what's familiar or what is safe. So if you're familiar with danger and screaming and yelling, you're okay with screaming and yelling. You know, if I go to a place where people are screaming and yelling, I'm getting the hell out of there. I can't cope with that. But if that was something you grew up with, you may go, yeah, I know how to deal with it. I actually like to get to a barroom brawl and kick some ass, you know. I wouldn't want to kick ass in the bar, you know. Like, but yeah. That's a different makeup.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.